Tonight on PBS News Weekend, a new report dissects U.S. Secret Service actions and missteps during the Capitol attack on January 6th. Following Donald Trump's attacks on Kamala Harris's race, a look at black identity and the history of race in politics. And as demand for copper and lithium grows, the increase in mining is posing new threats to Native communities here and around the world.
These kind of places shouldn't be lost, because if it's lost, it's lost forever, and it'll never come back.
Good evening. I'm Laura Barone Lopez. John Yang is away. Concerns of a wider conflict in the Middle East are escalating. Today, Iran said in a statement that it will exact severe revenge at the appropriate time. This after an attack in its capital killed a visiting Hamas leader. Iran blames Israel and the U.S. The veiled threats are prompting the Pentagon to send additional Navy destroyers to the Middle East. In the occupied West Bank, Israeli Defense Forces said it killed another Hamas leader today. The IDF hit a car that it says held the leader and four other Palestinian militants on their way to carry out an attack. The Defense Department revoked a controversial plea deal that took the death penalty off the table for the accused mastermind of the 9/11 attacks. In a memo, Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin said responsibility for the decision should be left with him, not the official appointed to oversee the cases. Prosecutors initially struck deals with Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and two of his accused accomplices over concern some evidence gathered through torture would not be admissible in court. The victims of the devastating wildfires on Maui could soon get help to rebuild. Hawaii's governor announced a settlement Friday worth more than $4 billion. It would pay out the families of the more than 100 people killed and the thousands displaced last August. The massive fire remains under investigation nearly 1 year later. The settlement needs to be finalized in court before the victims may receive payment. Olympian Simone Biles is living up to her nickname as one of the greatest of all time. The gymnast earned her 7th gold medal and 10th overall in Paris today during the women's vault final. Later in the day, Team USA picked up another gold in the pool. Swimmer Katie Ledecky raced past the competition for the women's 800-meter freestyle. This is her 9th gold in 4 Olympic Games. Still to come on PBS News Weekend, the history of racial identity in American politics and the impact of mining on indigenous communities in the U.S. and around the world.
This is PBS News Weekend from WETA Studios in Washington, home of the PBS NewsHour, weeknights on PBS.
The Secret Service is in the hot seat again, this time over its actions before and on January 6th. A new report from the Homeland Security Inspector General lays out several things the agency could have done better, from detecting a viable pipe bomb within 20 feet of then-Vice President-elect Kamala Harris to reporting signs of potential violence, like rallygoers wearing ballistic helmets, body armor, and other military-grade equipment. Joining us is Washington Post investigative reporter Carol Lenig. Carol, thank you so much for your time. This report, Secret Service officials never testified before the House committee investigating January 6th, and now this report seems to leave more questions than it does answers. What are your main takeaways from it?
You know, we knew some time ago that there had been a pipe bomb laid outside of both the RNC's special offices on Capitol Hill and the DNC minutes before Kamala Harris was going to be coming out and was in that building. She was spirited out of the building. It was known at the time, but this sort of concretizes this and makes it official. It's no longer just reporters learning it from their sources, but it's actually the government affirming this. The pipe bomb investigation by the FBI and the U.S. Attorney's Office in D.C. has been one of the most labor-intensive investigations in recent memory, and most labor-intensive for one that did not reach an answer. The FBI has still not discovered who were the people or persons who laid this potential explosive that could have gone off in both locations in the minutes before the Capitol was actually breached, and its security line was pressed through by protesters and supporters of Donald Trump's that day after they stormed away from his rally and towards the Capitol, as he urged them to do.
And Carol, I want to ask you, because you have a new exclusive out about a secret investigation into whether Donald Trump received cash from Egyptian President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi, allegedly, if you could walk us through, exactly how did $10 million possibly get from the government of Egypt to then-president-elect Donald Trump?
What happened and what was jaw-dropping for U.S. government investigators, federal prosecutors, FBI agents, was the CIA in early 2017 alerted the Department of Justice that they had credible intelligence from an informant and corroborated by additional intelligence gathering that el-Sisi had plans in late 2016 to basically inject or illegally give $10 million to Donald Trump's reelection efforts. That essentially he wanted to help Donald Trump get elected, and he was going to do this with $10 million under the table. Investigators looked and looked and looked to figure out if this intelligence was true. Could they figure out, was this money ever spirited to Donald Trump? Did he, in their words, accept a bribe? But the problem was, although they found a Cairo bank had made a bizarre withdrawal of cash, exactly matching the intelligence, $10 million pulled out of essentially the Egyptian CIA's account, just as the intelligence suggested. They found this withdrawal of cash stuffed into duffel bags 5 days before Donald Trump became president. But the problem for investigators in the United States was they wanted to get Donald Trump's records, his bank records, to determine, did that money from Cairo that was so suspicious, $10 million in U.S. bills, did it land in Donald Trump's accounts? And the U.S. attorney basically said, no, I'm not going to let you subpoena those records. You don't have enough evidence to do that. And Bill Barr, the attorney general at the time, was very suspicious of this request to subpoena for records and expressed doubts about whether or not this case was justified. In the end, the prosecutors and the FBI agents threw up their hands. They said they couldn't do this investigation without getting that information. And they were despondent because they felt they had a lot of evidence suggesting this could be true. They had to find out if it was, and they were never allowed to do that.
Yeah, that's pretty stunning, Carol. I mean, Egypt has been in the news a lot lately, namely because Democratic Senator Bob Menendez was convicted just last month of acting as a foreign agent for Egypt. Is there a possible pattern here of Egypt's efforts in trying to influence U.S. politicians?
The key linchpin in all of this, Laura, is, again, Egypt's General Intelligence Agency, essentially el-Sisi's CIA. This is an important spy network that Sisi has relied upon to pressure and push for his agenda abroad, especially in the United States. What Menendez's bribery conviction and trial showed was the General Intelligence Service's top officials were reaching out and making friends with Menendez and trying to steer him to push specific things that were important to Sisi on the world stage. It went so far as Menendez actually giving them some important information that was pretty sensitive about employees of our government who are in Egypt, which was pretty sensitive information. And it went so far that he took a lot of money from people who were operating at Egypt's bidding, and he was accused of being a foreign agent of that country. The General Intelligence Service, once again, Sisi's CIA, was the entity that the U.S. intelligence said would be used to spirit this money to Donald Trump. And the General Intelligence Service account is where that bizarre $10 million cash withdrawal came from.
Carol Lenig of The Washington Post, thank you for your time.
Thank you, Laura.
Earlier this week, speaking to a gathering of black journalists, former President Donald Trump questioned Vice President Kamala Harris's racial identity.
And now she wants to be known as black. So I don't know, is she Indian or is she black?
She has always identified as a black woman.
I respect either one. I respect either one, but she obviously doesn't. Because she was Indian all the way, and then all of a sudden she made a turn and she became a black person. Just to be clear.
It's not the first time Mr. Trump and other Republicans have accused a politician of color of not knowing their own race or ethnicity. Trump's comments on Wednesday echoed his lies about Harris in 2020 and Barack Obama during his presidency, that they were not natural-born American citizens. Peniel Joseph is the founding director of the Center for the Study of Race and Democracy at the University of Texas at Austin. He's also author of The Third Reconstruction, America's Struggle for Racial Justice in the 21st Century. I want to first note that back in 2020, Donald Trump's campaign spokesperson said that Kamala Harris is a black woman and pointed to donations that Trump had made to her earlier campaigns as evidence that he is not racist. But again, these are not the first instances of Trump questioning Harris's identity and her race. What is behind this?
I think this is a long-standing tradition of questioning the citizenship, the dignity, the authenticity of black political figures. When we think about Kamala Harris in this context, what Trump is doing is really talking to his own base. He's talking to white voters who are aggrieved by this idea, which is false, that they are being replaced by people of color. Sometimes they feel they're being replaced by Jews. So there is this racist, anti-Semitic strain that he is tapping into by saying she doesn't know whether she wants to be South Asian. She doesn't know whether she wants to be black. He's signaling to his followers that this is the coming wave that I'm here to protect you against.
As you noted, Donald Trump isn't the only white politician to question the identity of people of color or try to define who is or isn't really black. But how far does this go back? Where did it start? What's the history of it?
Well, the history of questioning people's racial identity goes back to antebellum America, where in certain contexts, African-Americans who are mixed race try to get their rights legally acknowledged by courts. And in this country, we really have a one-drop rule where whether your mother or father was white, you were legally defined as black as a species of property who could not be willed any estates, who couldn't be an heir of a white person, who couldn't run for public office, who couldn't sit in juries. Now, when we fast forward to the 20th and the 21st century, as we know, there's a whole bunch of African-Americans of mixed race heritage, but they're still identified as black in this country. Kamala Harris went to Howard University, historically black college. She's an AKA Alpha Kappa Alpha, which is part of the Divine Nine, historically African-American sorority and fraternities. She's lived her life as a black woman. In this context, the move to undermine the authentic experience of black people plays out in different contexts, both culturally, politically, economically. In this context, it's the denial that a black woman could be president of the United States, because in certain ways, that racial and gender barrier are one of the last symbolic barriers that we have to break.
I wanted to ask you about a Pew survey that dates back to 2022, where it found that race is very much a part of the identity for black Americans and how they connect to others. It found that 76% of black Americans say being black is extremely or very important to how they think about themselves. So what happens to black Americans when someone who is in a leading position like Donald Trump just openly questions who is or isn't black?
Well, I think it makes black Americans think about the solidarity and the unity of their shared history, right? And so in certain ways, Trump and these allegations against Kamala Harris, just like the allegations against Barack Obama that he wasn't an American citizen, are a distraction. And the late, great Nobel Prize winning writer Toni Morrison always reminds us that racism is a distraction. It distracts us from the work that we need to do. So I think right now, all the reaction that we're seeing is that the black community is really solidly behind the vice president, but also other groups are as well. So I think it's having the opposite effect. But again, I don't think it's intended to be directed to Black people.
When I covered the 2019 Democratic primary, even Democratic primary voters said to me that they weren't sure if the country was ready for a woman president or was ready for a woman of color to be president. Do you think that it's different now?
Well, yes. I mean, I think the country is always battling between two stories it's telling itself. One story is a Reconstructionist story that celebrates multiracial, multigender democracy. The other is a redemptionist story that really is about fear, anxiety, a racial caste system that subordinates Black people, women, people of color, Jews, people who are otherized in our society. And I think with the election of Barack Obama in 2008, that really opened up this third Reconstruction period in the United States, where we've been pushing for an embrace of multiracial democracy. Yet those redemptionist forces are still there, as we've seen with the vice president's run to be the first Black woman and South Asian woman president. It brings us closer to that idea of an aspirational America where we embrace multiracial democracy and we find strength in the difference and the diversity within our country.
Professor Peniel Joseph, the University of Texas at Austin, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
From computers to car batteries, minerals extracted from the earth help power many of our devices. But what about the communities whose land is at the center of acquiring these minerals? Just this week, Arizona Governor Katie Hobbs halted plans to transport uranium through Navajo Nation after the tribe raised concerns about how it could affect the reservation. Allie Rogan reports on the fight between companies seeking minerals from these lands and the indigenous tribes fighting to preserve them.
For Wenzler Nosey and fellow members of the San Carlos and other local Apache tribes, the Oak Flat Campground outside Phoenix is the site of sacred ceremonies and the resting place for many ancestors.
This is the home of our deities, where the deities live.
But it's also home to billions of pounds of copper, making it valuable to mining companies. Earlier this year, a federal court ruled in favor of developers looking to extract copper from deep underground.
They have to think this through, because there's not going to be copper here forever. And once it's all gone, then the whole South is contaminated forever.
Mineral mining has become a booming industry across the country and the world. As the demand for electric vehicles and the batteries that power them rises, so does the need to ramp up the supply of the minerals needed to make them. In recent years, demand for nickel, lithium, cobalt, and copper has grown exponentially. Between 2021 and 2023, the price for one ton of lithium in U.S. markets nearly tripled, reaching a high of $46,000 per ton last year.
Everything we see, touch, and feel in our modern life comes from minerals. And that's everything from the computers we're talking on to the chairs we're sitting in, even everything down to our smartphones comes from minerals.
Rick Tallman is a senior advisor to the Payne Institute for Public Policy at the Colorado School of Mines.
Critical minerals necessary for the energy transition, the ones that people talk about the most, that there is most focus on, are lithium and graphite. And the demand is soaring primarily because of electric vehicle demand.
Tallman says more than 300 new lithium mines worldwide are necessary to keep pace with the demand for electric vehicles. The Biden administration has prioritized a transition to renewable energy, setting a goal for half of all new cars to be electric by 2030. But some advocates say this green future is coming at the expense of indigenous communities, whose historic lands surround many of the reservoirs where these rare minerals are formed.
In many parts of the world, extractive companies are plowing ahead with mining projects without consulting with those communities.
Galina Angarova is the executive director of the Surge Coalition, an organization that advocates for indigenous people's environmental rights. She says mineral mining can risk endangering these communities.
It introduces pollution, surge of various diseases, respiratory issues, cardiovascular problems, cancer, more. It also leaves behind profound social impacts, including drug use, alcoholism, missing and murdered Indigenous women.
In fact, one study found a connection between the 2006 oil boom in the Bakken region of Montana and North Dakota and attacks against Native Americans there. The rate of violent victimization, which includes rape, assault, and robbery, increased 23% among Native people in the 6 years after the boom started. But in the surrounding counties that didn't produce oil, such violence decreased by 11%. Today, U.S. mining is regulated by a 19th century law written when westward expansion, encouraged by the federal government, was displacing Indigenous people. But in 2011, the U.S. adopted the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, which requires consent before starting a project on Native lands. But some legal experts say it doesn't go far enough.
There is a need to reassess the shortcomings of existing procedures so that they are sort of updated in light of current international law standards.
Leonardo Cripa is a senior attorney at the Indian Law Resource Center.
We are starting to see regressive legislative measures for the purpose of undermining rights are already protected by federal or provincial law for the purpose of paving the way and promoting mining activities.
It's a trend, Cripa says, is happening around the globe. In the so-called Lithium Triangle, spanning Argentina, Chile, and Bolivia, Indigenous communities sit on around 60% of the world's lithium supply. Last year, Chilean President Gabriel Boric announced his plan to take control of the lithium supply by partnering with mining companies.
Our challenge is to make sure our country transforms into the number one producer of lithium in the world, increasing wealth, development, and distributing it justly.
But some Native leaders are skeptical about his approach.
What Boric proposes is irresponsible because he isn't asking the Indigenous people. And this tone from the Chilean state to the Indigenous people is constant. It's not happening only now.
Cripa, who represents tribes in the Lithium Triangle, says mining companies employ tactics to bypass land use laws and access the white gold below. Companies are required to perform tests to determine potential environmental harm, but Cripa says the reports are rarely translated into the tribe's native languages.
They are not able to realize what is going on. They are not informed. They have no means to access the information. And as a result, this permit is granted to the company.
Some Indigenous communities are fighting back. Last summer, hundreds of tribal members took to the streets in Buenos Aires, Argentina, to protest mining in their territories.
It is looting, it is plundering, and irreversible damage to the Mother Earth.
While some argue mineral mining will help address the climate crisis by moving away from fossil fuels, Rick Tallman says it also creates an ethical dilemma with major consequences.
Across the world, Indigenous people are going to be the most impacted by sourcing these critical minerals that all of us need for a successful energy transition. But if we don't mine those minerals, they'll also be the most impacted by climate change if we fail.
But Tolman believes there are more sustainable alternatives. He says the U.S. could avoid producing new mines by making use of the thousands of abandoned uranium mines across Indian country, where he says energy resources already exist. But he says none of that work can be done without buy-in from Indigenous communities.
There is no possible pathway to a successful energy transition without the support and partnership and hopefully leadership from tribal communities and tribal nations.
For Galina Angarova, that collaboration is non-negotiable.
Indigenous peoples are not necessarily opposed to the green transition or development in general. Indigenous peoples are opposed to violating rights, destroying their way of life, and harming the priceless landscapes that define who we are as peoples.
Back in Arizona, Wenzler Nosey continues the traditions of his ancestors while he's still able.
These kind of places shouldn't be lost, because if it's lost forever, and it'll never come back.
For future generations of local Apache tribes, that fear could soon become a reality. For PBS News Weekend, I'm Allie Rogan.
And that's our program for tonight. I'm Laura Barone Lopez. For all of my colleagues, thanks for joining us. See you tomorrow.